In the mid-1980s, a fascinating story emerged. A man claiming to have worked out at a test site designated S4, which is part of the Groom Lake test site, came forward to tell his remarkable story to local Las Vegas news anchor George Knapp. I'll bet you George Knapp was out there at the Kreskin affair tonight with cameras. The man was Robert S. Lazar. Bob never claimed to have made contact with, worked with, or has ever seen any aliens at S4. But he did claim to have worked on a revolutionary propulsion system, seen saucer-shaped craft in a hangar built into the side of the mountain, and witnesses live trials, of a man flying disc. His story made headlines around the world, brought hundreds of thousands of people to the desert, spawned a multi-million-dollar publishing and merchandising circus, and shook up a country to the core of its beliefs. It is worth noting that for nearly 15 years now, Bob Lazar has never tried to embellish his story, change it, and neither the U.S. Military nor the government has ever denied any of it to be true. Bob Lazar, the man behind the legend of Area 51, as the center of a massive U.S. government cover-up surrounding craft alien spacecraft, has recently signed a deal with UK-based Blue Book Films to finally bring his unique story to the screen. And this is a man who does not do interviews. He's even worse than I am. I mean, he's very shy, probably somewhat reclusive. I get accused of being reclusive a lot, and I am. And I guess Bob is too. Bob, are you reclusive?
I guess you could say that.
you hardly ever do any interviews. I had one or two with you over many years, and that's been about it. I mean, you have not given that many, have you?
No, I really hate doing interviews. And
I understand.
Well, you know.
I do know, and I hate them too. And I refuse almost all of them. Every now and then I'll do one, I don't know why, but I hate them. And I especially hate television.
Yeah, I agree.
However, your story is really important. It's so important, they're now going to finally do a movie about it. How do you feel about them doing a movie about you?
Well, you know, this is the third try. Initially, Columbia Pictures wanted to do a movie some years back. And they hired a writer and spent somewhere around $400,000 to pay this guy to write the story.
Oh, my goodness.
That's a tremendous amount of money.
It is.
And, you know, essentially it's just a chronological list of events that you're going to have to form into a movie. However, writers want to get creative.
Oh, yeah, of course.
And, you know, this guy turned it into a James Bond story. There were actual scenes of the guy playing Bob Lazar running on the tops of cars that were parked on Las Vegas Boulevard in the silhouette of the erupting volcano in the background, and they had robots holding me underground trying to drown me to stop me from talking. I mean, some real ridiculous stuff. And, you know, my point is, if you're going to go make up a story about flying saucers, don't bother using my name. Just go ahead and make up a story. But if it's going to be accurate to the facts, then it has to be accurate to the facts. I understand there has to be a little glitter put in it somewhere to make the story flow or whatever makes Hollywood happy.
Yeah, but that's too much glitter, though.
You've got to stick to the facts and make it at least somewhat factual.
So what, you got a chance to read this and said, I'm sorry, I'm not associating with this, or what?
Well, they never give you right of refusal to the script.
Dealing
with a movie company, and I'm sure you know that.
So then you go, my God, what have they done to me?
Huh. Exactly. But, the only thing you can really do is just say, you know, hey, I'm not going to support it. Because they essentially force you to go do other interviews on TV and whatnot, and you know, they're going to sit you down, and the first thing you're going to say, well, is this an actual account of your life? And you're going to have to say no.
Yeah.
And, you know, there goes the movie. So
The thing is, though, that the real story itself, is so compelling? Or have we gone so far into the world of science fiction that as compelling as your story is, and it's an incredible story, it's not enough for the screen without embellishment?
Maybe not. There's no explosions. There's no shootouts with aliens. You know, there's it's just an account of events that, you know, happened at a secret installation out in Nevada. And the end of the exact same thing happened with New Line, who bought it from Columbia. They tried it. They tried to not produce the film, but first they tried to get it written and get it into production. And they hired another writer. And one of the first things I said was, make sure you get a guy that's familiar with science to some degree, because it's a technical film.
Right.
And the first day I met this guy, they flew him down, and he said, now, what are these things called atoms again?
Oh, no, really?
This is a terrible start.
Yeah.
And anyway.
So now, what about this? Okay, so what about this new company, Blue Book, that's got it now? What's the promise?
Well, supposedly, and from everything so far that I've heard, sounds like they're going to follow an actual account of the events that happened.
Of your story.
Yeah, which is great. You know, that's fine. I've got no problems with that at all. And, you know, they're really not going to embellish anything. They're not going to say anything that didn't happen. And what more could you ask for?
Okay. Let's get the real story. Bob, you're a physicist, correct?
Mm-hmm. Well, I was at one time. Right now, I'm not doing anything.
Yeah, I know. Take me back to way before S4 and before Area 51 and all the rest of it, and just tell me something about yourself. I mean, how did you get interested in the things you're interested in that eventuated in your getting that job? How did you get to be who you are?
Well, I wonder how far I should go back. I guess at one point, I had moved to New Mexico in the early 80s, and that was to take on a job with Los Alamos National Lab.
What kind of work?
Well, that was physics. That was with the at the Los Alamos Maison Physics Facility, which now has a different name.
Okay.
You know, it's been quite a while ago. But at the time, we were running experiments on their linear accelerator there, and really looking into the basic makeup of matter.
That's pretty exciting. That's pretty exciting work, period.
Oh, it was fantastic. It was a lot of fun working there. A very strange town to live in, but you know, I enjoyed it quite a bit.
How long were you with them, with Los Alamos?
Los Alamos, I believe I was there only a couple years mm-hmm. before I realized that, you know, I could make a lot more money on my own just operating as a contractor and consulting for the lab as opposed to working for them.
Mm-hmm. That happens a lot.
Oh, and it was certainly worth doing. So I left the lab and at that time started Lazar Energy Systems. And we developed, designed, and repaired radiation detection equipment.
Radiation detection equipment?
Mm-hmm. Specifically, alpha radiation detection, which is the type of particles given off by plutonium, and Los Alamos making bombs and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Has a lot of plutonium lying around, so they want to be able to detect even minute particles that may cling to clothing, so on and so forth.
So, in other words, this was a sort of a protective detective device.
Right.
For
right.
human
they,
beings.
They essentially frisk you with it
yep.
when you leave. It also scans the floors and cars as they leave, too.
Was that a pretty good business to be in?
Yeah. It was fantastic.
Huh.
It was absolutely fantastic at the time. And we were awarded a government contract about 4 years in a row, and things were great.
Well,
I did still go down to the lab a lot because I knew people there. And one day, there was a local Los Alamos newspaper called The Monitor.
Right.
And, you know, at the time, I was building all kinds of strange projects and was really into building things with jet engines in them and built...
really?
Yeah, race cars, and I even built a little Honda passenger car that had a jet engine in it.
Jet engine?
Yeah.
In a car?
It was,
well, how does that work, Bob? How does a jet engine in a car work? I mean, there's this famous myth of the the guy who plowed himself into a mountain with some jets. I mean, how does a jet...
That was a Jado rocket.
That Jado rocket, that's
right.
It, yeah.
Yeah, it's a famous urban legend.
It is. But in real life, how in God's name do you...
In real life, this was, I think it was, I don't remember the year, 1980-something or other, Honda Civic, which had the engine up front.
Right.
And in the back, I installed a jet engine. So you could drive the car around normally, and then push a lever, and the license plate would open up, exposing the nozzle to the jet. You could fire that up and take off at high speed. And they had put that on, I think it's the June 82 front page of the Monitor newspaper. And
what kind of jet engine was that? Do you recall?
It's a pressure jet engine, which is kind of it's a jet engine with no moving parts at all.
Right.
And you know, if you know how jet engines, turbojet engines, and the like work,
I do.
Generally, that's real confusing because you need some moving parts in there to make things go.
That's right.
And it's not a ramjet, and ramjets need to be moving at extremely high speed before they can produce thrust. But this is kind of a strange hybrid, and it produces thrust statically without it moving.
That's really cool. How much thrust, do you know?
That was about 2,000 pounds.
2,000
pounds. For a 1,600-pound car, that was...
Yeah, oh, yeah. So in other words, you're already moving at, like, what, 50, 60 miles an hour when you let go?
Yeah, exactly.
And then what?
Well, and then you better hold on.
Yeah, well, how fast? I mean, it takes you from 60 to what?
212 was the fastest we ever had that car going.
212 miles an hour?
Yeah.
You out your mind. Where were you driving these things?
The high-speed run was done at El Mirage Dry Lake in California. And the car was pretty much retired after that because it was a unibody construction and the whole car started pretty much bending from all the forces.
What?
But, I mean, the only reason I brought up the whole jet car thing was that...
You were the driver, right?
Right.
Did you have a death wish?
No, that kind of stuff isn't dangerous if you know what you're doing.
Well, I mean, for example, the car had shaken apart during, you know, maximum thrust.
Yeah, but it didn't.
Well, right, it didn't, but it bent itself up pretty well, huh?
Yeah, that was kind of expected.
Now, I know that you have a car that, I remember when we interviewed before, you had built a car that runs on hydrogen also, right?
Yeah, that was a 1978 Trans Am, and in fact, I entered that in an alternate fuels contest, which was a race at that time from Woodland Hills to California to Kitt Peak, Arizona, and it drove nonstop there on one tank of fuel.
Well, you know, that's interesting, because that's a long time ago, and now all of a sudden President Bush is saying we are going to begin moving toward a hydrogen economy.
Well, we should. I mean, it's the perfect fuel. In fact, I was just talking to my girlfriend the other day saying I think I'm going to go ahead and convert our existing car over.
Really?
And I kind of miss making my own fuel. I mean, it's essentially free.
Okay, but here's the question, and I talked to a lot of people about this, Bob. Right now, I think the oil companies imagine hydrogen is fine because, you know, they'll use fossil fuels to put the hydrogen... Create the hydrogen, get it in the cells. You still have to use energy to make energy, right?
However, there are other ways. Now, of course, the oil companies and the gas companies want you to crack hydrogen from methane or some other hydrocarbon fuel.
Absolutely.
That's ridiculous. You're defeating the whole purpose of using hydrogen. Water is H2O.
Yeah.
Now, you know, every school kid knows you take a glass of water, you know, add just a drop of salt in there to get the ions moving around, and take a 12-volt battery and put the positive and negative leads in there. You see one lead let off a little bit of bubbles, and the other lead lets off twice as much bubbles. Well, the lead with twice as much bubbles is the H2, and the O2 is coming off the other one. So just running a little electricity through water gives you a flammable gas.
And
that's
so,
the way to make hydrogen.
Okay. So other than the creation of the voltage... to do that, which...
Well, the way I had done it before was I had a fairly large solar array, and what that did was during the day, it took and cracked the using an electrolysis setup,
right,
which is what I just described, cracked the hydrogen out of water, And during the night, it was pressurized using the available water pressure into the hydrogen tanks, which contained an iron titanium hydride. It's kind of a granular substance that absorbs hydrogen like a sponge soaks up water,
uh-huh.
as opposed to just compressing a tank with hydrogen, which is a dangerous.
I was about to ask you, in this process, is there a danger?
No, once it's chemically stored in the hydride, you can shoot incendiary bullets at the tank, and it just does nothing but smolder.
But the gas itself could be dangerous.
Yeah, but the tank only produces as much gas as the car needs at the time.
Gotcha.
The way the setup that I came up with is that the car radiator fluid heats an outer jacket on the tank, and when the hydride heats up, it evolves hydrogen, and it gets into the carburetor. So there's never more than the volume of hydrogen that fits in the tube from the tank to the carburetor or fuel injection system. So it was a very safe system.
All right, what about the car itself, the performance of the car compared to a piston engine? What was the performance like?
We're talking about the hydrogen car or the jet?
Oh, the jet, I can imagine that. the hydrogen car.
The hydrogen car, it is a piston car. And, you know, the beauty of the system is you can convert any existing piston car to run on hydrogen.
Yes, but
you just need to retard the timing because hydrogen burns so much faster. The flame front just flashes through the cylinders and it'll cause detonation or knocking. But with a couple minor modifications, any car can run on it. And you do lose a little horsepower because it's, you know, there's a difference between spraying a flammable gas in there as opposed to having, you know, a liquid hydrocarbon with all that carbon energy in there.
Well, when you say a little, how much real difference in performance?
Well, I lost a significant amount in the Trans Am, and you know, probably I believe the car was 220 horsepower, and I think I was down to about 150 running on hydrogen.
Oh, but still usable then.
Oh, yeah, you weren't following electric cars by any means.
Well, that's pretty good. That's damn good, actually. So why not do that now to all cars?
I am. I'm going to convert my car over. But
your wife is okay with this, right?
Right.
Bob, hold on a sec. We're at the bottom of the hour. I'm Art Bell. Once again, here is Bob Lazar. And it's good that you've told us some of this, Bob. It gives it, you know, kind of everybody a background for, you know, what kind of guy you are and what you've been doing. And sounds like you've been having a hell of a lot of fun, actually. I mean, putting a jet in a car, that's got to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was. A crazy thing to do.
And a lot of people, do you have a website?
Well, there's a website about me that's not mine. Website is unitednuclear.com, which is scientific supplies and whatnot that we sell.
Somebody was hoping you'd post the process for the creation of hydrogen on some website somewhere or something. Well, they'll have to dig back in the archives and listen. All right, so now, how did you get involved, if you can remember the first moment or the first contact that anybody made with you regarding Area 51 and S4 and all that stuff over here?
Well, this is the reason why I brought up the jet car initially. That day, June 82, the front page of the Los Alamos Monitor newspaper had a picture of me in the jet car on it. And on the flip side of the front page, there's an announcement there that Edward Teller, father of the hydrogen bomb, mm-hmm. Was going to be giving a lecture down at one of the lecture halls at the lab. And I was anxious to hear the lecture. So thinking there were going to be lots of people there, I got there really early because
uh-huh.
at the time I was still working for the lab.
Right.
Or was it? Now I'm trying to remember.
Boy,
I was still working for it. But in either case, I got to the lecture hall real early. And as it turned out, there was nobody there. And now I'm kind of waiting around. About 15 minutes goes by, and I see Ed Teller sitting on a little wall outside the hall reading the front page of the newspaper.
Really?
Which I thought was a perfect segue for me to introduce myself because, you know, he's sitting there reading about me, and I always wanted to meet the guy.
Of course.
And so I went and introduced myself, and, you know, we talked for a bit, and actually the lecture got delayed a little bit, so we had walked around, and you know, I got to talk to the guy.
What was he like, out of curiosity? I mean, how did he strike?
He was a very stubborn guy.
Stubborn.
Yeah, and it's a feeling you get speaking to most of the older scientists and physicists at almost every lab I've seen. You can't present them with anything new that they didn't think of first.
Yeah.
You know, they're scientists. They're supposed to be open-minded and explore new ideas and things, but there is nobody as closed-minded, you know, as a scientist or physicist that's been in the business, you know, for over a decade.
Can you remember the conversation that that made you form that opinion?
No, this is an opinion not just based on him, but based on the other scientists and physicists that I've worked with.
Ah.
They all act exactly the same.
Oh, and you caught the same drift from him.
Yeah, identical. And anyway, I got to see the lecture, and, you know, time passed. And actually, as time went on, I moved out of Los Alamos and moved to Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
And after some time there, involved in other businesses, I kind of missed being back in the mainstream science field and started sending out resumes. EG&G and I wonder who else was around there at the time. But
people might not know, EG&G is, I think they're a contractor for... for Area 51, for the test site.
For the test site, yeah, right. And they're EG&G measurements. In fact, those are the guys that, in fact, Edinger, who's the E in EG&G, is the guy, I think, that invented the flash, the xenon flash bulb or high-speed flash photography, something like that.
Okay.
Because EG&G started out as the company that came up with a way to photograph the atomic tests, mm-hmm. which was really difficult. And
yeah, it's
anyway.
A big flash, be very hard to photograph.
Yeah, very high speed, and you know they wanted to actually see the fireball expanding as it cracks the case and moves apart, and you know you're talking over a million frames a second.
Wow!
And they came up with some fantastic cameras. In fact, I was just told the other day by a movie studio executive that all those old cameras found their way into most of the motion picture companies now, and they use them for special effects, all those atomic bomb cameras.
Yeah, we got a lot of you know, scientific advance from defense, if you wish to call it that, and the defense industry. Of course, you know, they develop the latest stuff, I guess, so it's not a surprise. So you applied to EG&G.
I'd sent a resume to everywhere that was in driving distance. Now, there wasn't a whole lot in Las Vegas, but, you know, I gave it a shot. And what I also did was I sent one to Dr. Teller, who was at Livermore at that time.
Hoping he'd remember you, I'm sure.
Right, and I referenced our meeting and so on and so forth. Uh-huh. And, you know, if any suggestions, you know, just pass them along. And I believe it wasn't too long after that that I got a call from EG&G.
Really?
Now, at that time, EG&G was located at McCarran Airport.
Okay.
It was EG&G Special Projects, and for the people who lived in Las Vegas a long time, they remember that. They've since moved it behind the fence at Nellis Air Force Base.
Okay.
And
they said to you what?
They told me to come down for an interview. I did, and apparently... This was under the recommendation of Dr. Teller, which was fantastic.
Of course.
And
did you know that, by the way, at the time?
I think I found that out after, if I recall.
Okay.
So
in this interview, what did they want? What were they after? What were they curious? What did they want to know?
The initial interview was for a lesser position. And I was interviewed by a board of people over a span of about an hour and a half. And
that's some interview.
Yeah, it was pretty intimidating. You know, it was an uncomfortable interview.
Do you recall the any of the key questions I asked you? I was an hour and a half, my God.
Not for that, because I did go back for another one.
Oh.
I mean, they did ask me. One of the strange things I found about it was that they weren't asking me that many technical questions. They were asking me questions about my demeanor, about what I do under stress. If I get all angry, do I start throwing screwdrivers and things around? And which was kind of weird. You expect them to, you know, certainly have. Well, they did have some technical questions and test my abilities, but
well, you know, that is, though, not that irrational a question. I've thrown screwdrivers.
Well, generally I don't. I just, you know, give up and walk away for a while.
Yeah, I know.
But I assume what they were doing was just they knew of my work at Los Alamos and the other things I was doing, and they just assumed that it fit the bill.
Sure, but they wanted to know about your demeanor for some reason.
Right, as it turned out, this all had to do with security, as I found out later. But I went home. I wasn't that thrilled about the interview, and it was several days later I got a call back, and they said, you know, as it turned out, we felt you were overqualified for the job we were offering, and we're pretty sure you would become bored with it after a while. However, there is something else that we have. I'm trying to remember verbatim what they said. I believe it's at a remote site on the test site, so you will have to fly out there.
And everybody should know that those flights leave every single day from Las Vegas and go up to the test site, right?
Yeah, at the time they were called the Key Flights, because Key Something Airlines had the contract.
They still fly every day.
Do they? Yeah.
Sure.
I didn't even I didn't know if the test site was still operational now.
Oh, yeah. It is. We have here in Pahrump, it's kind of interesting. The test site that doesn't exist. We have every morning. They may have stopped it now, but up at the VFW Lodge up the street from me here, they have a parking lot at the VFW Lodge, and they have buses at about like 4 something in the morning, little before 5 in the morning, and on the side of the bus it says Area 51.
No kidding.
Yeah,
really?
No kidding. Yeah, no kidding. And they pile in and they bus from here in Pahrump, but there in Las Vegas they fly, and they still fly. So, yeah, you're right about that.
Well, they had me come down for an interview that was a little more in-depth that time, and I did very well. And they would say they told me that it was going to be fairly heavy security, and it was going to be working on an advanced propulsion system. No, that's great. This is exactly what I want to do. You know, here's the guy that's tinkering around with jets and running on hydrogen. I mean, propulsion was my thing. It's stuff I even played around with when I, you know, was at home.
A natural thing for you.
Right. You know, certainly excited about it. And I was under the impression that this was going to be a field propulsion system for some new fighter aircraft, a field propulsion system like some sort of electromagnetic drive, something with that uses some of the basic forces of repulsion and attraction, whether it's extremely high voltage or who knows what.
Bob, at that time, you obviously knew about the test site. Everybody knows about the test site.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know about some, you know, had you heard the rumors of a secret base up there when way back then?
I'm trying to remember. I probably did. And in fact, thinking back, I almost remember there were some silly stories about aliens working out there and whatnot. And, you know, I was a hardcore non-UFO believer. I mean, I thought all that stuff was absolutely ridiculous, and the people that believed it were even more ridiculous. So I didn't pay much attention to any of that stuff. But I think I did hear, you know, on KLS TV or something, or one of George Knapp's interviews with John Lear or something like that.
Okay.
That there were aliens working up there or eating people or whatever the story was about.
Okay. Yeah, those were back in the days. In fact, I was doing shows on it with John Lear back then. And so those rumors were around. So you sort of vaguely knew about them but didn't pay a lot of attention. And so did you have any idea where you were going to be working? Did they tell you that?
No, they just said a remote site, a remote area on the test site. And, you know, wherever that was going to be was fine.
Well, that's got to get your blood going a little bit. I mean,
well, it does. I was excited, and it was, you know, a job on the cutting edge of technology, so I was, you know, I was back at home again. They had a strange way of calling me to work. It was initially, apparently I was supposed to be replacing somebody.
Uh-huh.
And there was kind of a rush to get me up to speed. Now, because I worked at Los Alamos, I had Q clearance, which is civilian top secret. So, you know, they knew I wasn't a foreign agent or anything like that.
Right.
However, this required a higher clearance to work at the site.
Higher than Q.
Right. And what happened next?
Well, they probably investigated you is what happened.
Yeah, they started doing that, and there were visits to the house. Even when I had a house full of people over, guests having a little get-together, there would just be guys knocking at the door and would just show themselves in and start looking through the house. And, you know, lots of people witnessed this stuff going on, and it began to really interfere with my life. Shortly after the investigation started, they allowed me out to the site. Now, they didn't start handing over everything or showing me everything. But
how did you get to the site?
I drove. Well, first they'd call. The job was not something like a 9 to 5 or every day at 7 o'clock be there. You were almost on call initially, and somebody would call from EG&G, and the phone call would go exactly like this. You pick up the phone and they say, "Hello, Mr. Lazar. It is now 4:43 p.m. We expect you to be at the installation at, you know, 6:25. It was always an odd number, and that's it. And
that's
they hang up the
weird.
Phone.
That's
it's very
weird.
Strange.
Yeah.
And but every time I went out there, I pick up the phone. They tell me what the current time was, and they tell me what the time they expected me out there was. And I drive out to McCarran Airport. I drive to the Special Projects EG&G building.
Yes.
And right in back of that at the time is really where the key flights took off from. Or at least where they parked. Anyway, that was the gateway to getting on the plane.
Did they black the windows out? There's stories that people who traveled up
there. Not there. But once you got, the plane flew from McCarran to Groom Lake.
Right.
Which is the only big runway out there.
And it's really big.
Yeah, it's giant. Once you get there, you get in a bus and drive about 15 miles south. That was the bus with the blacked out windows.
Blacked out
windows.
Those
stories are definitely true. In fact, I've got a picture of one of the buses.
How many people typically would be in that bus ride with you going south?
I never saw more than three people, myself included.
Wow. Wow. Okay. So your initial employment, was that just at the test site, or did they begin taking you south to S4 immediately?
They began taking me to S4 immediately. In fact, we weren't really allowed to wander around or anything at Groom. We just sat there, waited either at the cafeteria or right where we were for the bus if it wasn't there, and it drove us down south to S4, which is a short drive on a dirt road.
Huh. You know, of course, they don't admit any of that even exists out there, but there are now zillions of photographs courtesy of the Russians and other satellites and even planes that have been nearby, and all there's a lot of photographs of Area 51, so we all know it's
right
out there, and we all know the runway's there, despite what they say. It's all
a lot
there.
Of people even disputed the road that I talked about,
right,
and said, no, it's impossible for it to be there. And John Andrews, the guy that worked for the Tester Model Corporation that was so into all of this, he's the one that came up, you know, that tried to buy the satellite photograph from the U.S. government, and they wouldn't sell it to him because they said it's classified, and he's the one that bought it from the Russians for $1,500.
Is he really the
yeah,
one?
Yeah, that's where that photograph came from. And with that photograph, you know, we blew it up, and there's the road exactly where I said, going right to the side of the mountain where the hangars are. So it that really did help out. So it's kind of strange that Americans have to go, you know, to a foreign country to get stuff that they're hiding from America.
Yeah, especially the Russians.
Yeah, that's just absurd. But
do you remember clearly, and I bet you do, the first day that you took that bus to S4? Did you know it was called S4?
Yeah.
They told you you're going to an area called S4.
Yeah, yeah, they did. There's actually signs out there.
There are signs?
Yeah, there are actual signs out there.
Because the average person never gets to see them.
No, no.
All right, a good place to hang out. Once again, Bob Lazar. Bob, can you remember the first ride down to S4 in the bus, blacked out bus? You remember that, huh?
Yeah, I do. That was quite a day.
Well, give me a sense. What was it like?
Well, the first time I went down there was essentially to read. I was brought into a small room at the facility they had there, and these, I guess you just call them briefings, because they were just an overview of some of the other satellite projects going on.
That's interesting.
Well, going on that were connected to what I was doing. I'm just trying to find a good way to put this.
In other words, they had to give you enough of an overview so you'd have some understanding of what you were about to work on.
Right, because just like they do at Los Alamos or any other national lab where you work on high security systems and subsystems, is they compartmentalize everything. And what they do is they have people working on different aspects of one project, so nobody really knows how the whole thing connects together. Well, some people do, but for the most part, most of the people working on it only work on, you know, a specific module, a specific subsystem, and, you know, somebody else worries about what it connects to.
Uh-huh.
And that way your knowledge about what's going on is limited just to the thing you worked on.
Makes sense.
It was the same here. And because this was a back engineering project, we weren't teaming together to try and build something. We were essentially teaming together to try and find out how something was built. You had to have a little knowledge of what was on the other side of the wall.
Yeah.
You know, what the next guy was doing. So they gave you a little briefing about some of the other aspects of what was going on. But not too much in detail, but just enough so you go, well, okay, I know where this plugs into.
Did they tell you that you were to be working on propulsion systems that were not ours?
No, not until later. Even though it became pretty obvious that's what was going on initially. I began reading what the people had done before me, and immediately they're talking science fiction about power sources that put out tremendous amounts of energy at propulsion systems with technology that doesn't even exist. And you begin to wonder if these guys are testing you in some way.
Of course.
And this is just a joke or what.
So it was like reading science fiction?
Initially it was. And it wasn't until the next time that I came down that I discovered it wasn't. The following time I came down, which was only my second time to work, one of the hangar doors was open. Now, I believe it was open intentionally.
Sure.
And instead of going around the side of the building in the main entrance, we stopped out in front and cut in through the hangar. And it was obvious it was in the hangar. The second I stepped out of the bus, there was a large disc-shaped craft sitting on its belly on the ground.
Okay, not on what would be some sort of touchdown or landing gear.
No landing gear,
like
no man-made support. It was sitting on the concrete, on its belly, on the ground.
And it was a disc, a typical flying saucer-type disc?
Yes.
How big do you think it was?
Well, John Andrews and I spent some time working on that, and he brought some people down from the model division, so we could scale things up by trying to guess my distance from it and looking at objects that I knew approximately what the size was, so they could crunch all the numbers through and figure out within a fairly good estimate how big the craft was. That came out to about 52 feet in diameter.
That's pretty big, 52 feet, huh?
Yeah, it was big. It was big.
And when you saw that, there must have been this moment where the jaw drops and you go, oh, my gosh. You know, I've just...
Well, not at that time. You would kind of think of it. But when I left the bus and I saw that, to me, it had the opposite effect. It said, see, I'm right. There are no flying saucers. This is just an advanced U.S.-made aircraft, and they've been testing it, and people think it's aliens from outer space. It made complete sense. And, in fact, when I walked by the craft, there was a little backwards American flag stuck on right next to the opening in the craft. Well, that absolutely does it. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. By the time I walked in, it made complete sense. This was the big new secret fighter that was going to replace the F-15 and who knows what else. And, I was going to work on the propulsion system. So,
Actually, it would make more sense that you would think that, especially with a little American flag. That was a nice touch.
Yeah, absolutely. Later did I learn to find out that was more or less a sticker that says this belongs to us now, as opposed to we made this.
Did you get introduced to who was to be your boss? Is boss the right word?
Yeah, kind of. It was tough to really figure out who your boss was there. They worked on the buddy system. And, you know, what moves science forward is free discussion. It's people sitting around working on a common problem and discussing things.
Sure.
It's just brainstorming.
Yes.
Especially for something outrageous like this.
Uh-huh.
But that was not permitted. What they did is they had a buddy system. You had one person who you worked with, who you could talk to. There was no communication with anybody else, not even if you sat down for lunch.
Now, how interesting is that, Bob? Because you were talking about the atomic bomb earlier in Teller.
Mm-hmm.
And they had the same arguments in the development of the atomic bomb that they weren't
exactly.
were not allowed to sit around and throw ideas back and forth, and that it was holding the whole damn project up.
It's exactly what was happening here, and all that has told me is that since the 40s, the military has not changed the way they do anything, and it's probably the reason why this project moved ahead so slowly. They were more concerned about security than moving anything forward.
And, of course, I guess they did not give anybody any idea where they got these craft. Or did they?
Well, in one of the briefings, they said information gained from the craft, and they really didn't say how, but that the craft came from the Zeta Reticuli star system. Which is apparently a binary star system that you can only see from the southern hemisphere.
That is exactly correct. And the one thought to perhaps hold a possibility of harboring life, and you're right, it can only be seen from way down south. I believe it cannot even be seen from Puerto Rico, where Arecibo is. Now, that's really interesting. So they actually did say, from information gleaned in the investigation of this craft, they thought it was Zeta Reticuli.
That's how it was worded.
Okay, so to work you go on what?
Well, the first person I was introduced to was a guy by the name of Barry Castillo or Castillo. I don't know how you pronounce that name. But I was introduced to him. This was the guy I was going to be working with. And we had a moderate-sized lab, and specifically we were working on the power source and the propulsion system of the craft.
So he was your buddy?
He was my buddy that I was going to work with.
Uh-huh.
In the lab, the first day in the lab meeting him, he was a very down-to-earth guy, and what was there was a reactor moved from one of the craft and one of the propulsion mechanisms that were on the bench. So they had already removed something. Now, At that time, I had only seen one craft.
The one you described, yeah.
Right.
Okay.
And as it turned out, there were nine there.
Nine, right. And we'll get to that. But these This portion of the propulsion system, or the main portion of the propulsion system, do you remember what your initial impression? Listen, by the way, I don't know if I'm going to press you to talk about things that you are unable to. How much are you unable to talk about, or unwilling to talk about, or will get in trouble for talking about? Is there anything that you hold back that you have to hold back?
Well, the only things that there are a couple things that I haven't said, and for a reason. It's not that, there's a new news flash or something, I just want to say that's new. The only reason there are some things I've held back was so I can recognize somebody from the area. Yeah, you know how all the chats and whatnot that go on the internet there, they're full of just nutcases.
I know.
And on both sides of the fence, though. I mean, you have people that will swear up and down, you know, I never lived in Los Alamos, I never worked there, or who knows what. But on the other side of the fence, you also have people that, just because they want to support me, say that, I was a security guard or something there, and I saw Bob going to work every day. Well, you know, both of those people don't help. because neither of them are true. And you know, as much as I appreciate the help from people that say stuff like that, it really doesn't help, because all it does is confuse matters. And, you know, in this field of UFO research, or whatever they call it these days, is so inundated with garbage and just ridiculous stories, you do not need to add even 1% more, because it's impossible for anybody to take anything seriously. So there were only 22 people working there.
22?
Yeah. And I have the list of them.
You have a list of the names?
Of every person that worked there.
Oh, my
God. Every person that had clearance for that. Now, that's the only thing I've kept to myself. There were a couple other little things here and there, and they talked me into releasing them in the movie, and that's fine. But the number one thing are the names. I mean,
the name, of course.
There's so many times you hear people say, well, I've got a friend that worked there. Really, what was his name? You know? And I've never seen a name come through.
Well, when you and your buddy first saw this propulsion stuff, how did it hit you as a physicist? What did you, when you look at it, you said to yourself, I'm looking at what?
Well, the first thing I saw that was absolutely mind-boggling, and I will never forget it, was the reactor operating. Now, this is something very small, probably on a base 12 or 15 inches square, with about a basketball size sphere on top.
Okay.
Well, semi-sphere. It's, you know,
right,
the basketball sitting on the plate.
Right.
This was the reactor for the craft. This produced a tremendous amount of energy, and also it was the source of the gravitational propulsion system, where it got its basic gravity wave from that they amplify. Now, these are, you know, we know what the effects of gravity are, but we cannot produce gravity or any gravity. You know, I've spoken to a lot of people, and I ask people, you know, that you see in NASA training films, astronauts floating around. And, you know, that's all done in that large plane that they put into a crash dive, and people go weightless inside.
Vomit comet.
Right, the vomit comet, exactly. You know, the majority of people I've spoken to, even people that seem fairly not knowledgeable to me, think that NASA has an anti-gravity device in this room where they just turn it on and people float around. Now, if we had something like that, there wouldn't be airplanes anymore. Cars would fly. I mean, the world would be changed. We don't have a machine that can make gravity, because if you do, you can also control time. So if we had something like that, the world would be so different.
All right,
we probably wouldn't even be on the radio here. Go ahead.
This device that you just talked about, that you just described, how did you and your buddy endeavor to measure its energy output, and in what form? How did you take a look at it?
Well, the like I was describing, the first time I saw it operating, all he had to do was put the lid, the semisphere, on top of this device, and it became operational. And he said, just put your hand on the top of it. And when I did, I could not touch it. It was the exact sensation of taking two like-pole magnets and trying to push them together.
Wow.
But it was just my hand approaching a metal sphere. Now, that in itself is shocking, because there's nothing that can do that.
In other words, you felt a repelling force, as in, like a wall? I mean, you just could push on it?
I could push. Starting from probably about a foot away, I could begin to feel something. And as I got closer, it got more intense. And probably at 2 to 3 inches, it was impossible to make contact with it. And you could push on the top. Your hands would slide to the bottom. It was a very intense field. And he had a golf ball there. And we even something moving at high speed could not penetrate the field. This was the basic gravity wave that the system produced.
Did you determine it to be a 360 degree field?
No, it wasn't.
It wasn't?
It wasn't. And again, that's something else. It's a completely directional gravity field only on the skin of the hemisphere.
Oh, my.
And it didn't appear on the base at all. And so this alone was just absolutely mind-boggling, because here's a machine doing the impossible. The next thing that I was shown, and it couldn't be a magic trick. It's my hand approaching a metal sphere. There's no room for any question there.
And what did your buddy, you and your buddy, discuss at that point? I mean, you obviously asked questions, or he offered information, or he just said...
Well, this was the initial introduction to what was going on, and... I mean, you could see it in his eyes. He took pride in showing off what they had, because the next thing he showed me was connecting it to the amplifier, and he said, you want to see something really neat now.
Yeah?
As if that wasn't amazing. There is, how am I going to describe this? There's a fitting, almost like a pipe, that slides down and makes contact with the hemisphere.
Okay.
This apparently, from what was described to me, is a tuned pipe, almost like
resonant.
Waveguides are tuned for microwaves to pass through.
Would be resonant.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
So once this pipe is placed upon the hemisphere, the field completely disappears. So that's giving you evidence that it's now traveling through the waveguide.
Uh-huh.
The waveguide goes to another extremely large tube, probably about 2 feet in diameter, 4 feet long, and has plates, I guess is the best way I can describe it, on the outside. This is actually the emitter, the gravity emitter. There's something in between the two, which is the actual amplifier.
Hold it right there, Bob. We're at the bottom of the hour. We'll pick it. Once again, here's Bob Lazar. And by the way, he's not in Las Vegas anymore, I don't think. Bob, you're somewhere else now, aren't you?
The mountains of New Mexico.
Back to New Mexico, huh?
Yeah.
Cool. That's a
literally
nice place to be, yeah. All right. What you were describing, the first thing you were describing that you saw, that was obviously a driver. Well, you know, in broadcasting, it would be the driver unit, the generator itself.
Right.
And now you're starting to describe what terrestrials would regard as waveguide or whatever carries this energy to some kind of amplifier, huh?
Exactly. However, if I can take 1 second and just step back to the hydrogen thing, the only reason I'm saying this is because, I guess because of the show,
sure,
there are a million people hitting the United Nuclear website and asking me to post some kind of instructions about.
I told you.
Yeah, so I'm going to go, there's no way I can answer all the emails, so I'll go ahead and generate a web page about that. So,
well, you could either do that or give out your home phone number.
Yeah, I'd rather do the web page.
Okay.
So there'll be some information up there eventually.
Thank you.
Gotta give me some time to do that.
On behalf
okay.
of the millions out there. Yes.
Back to the reactor.
Right.
Or the propulsion system. The way it was configured was supplying the basic wave, the basic gravitational wave, to the amplifier and to the emitter. In the craft, there are three emitters.
Three.
In a triad pattern.
Uh-huh.
And what I found interesting is, you know, after being involved with the project, that kind of made me start looking into UFO stories to see what's true and what's not.
Yeah, sure.
And there were so many stories, especially at rash of Belgian sightings in early 90s, I think, or middle 90s, where they saw from the, on the bottom of the craft three bright spots of light.
Right.
And that is exactly how this operated. Another interesting thing was, I know I'm jumping ahead of myself here, but the other craft that were there all had the same power and propulsion system in it.
All three emitters?
Yeah, which I found really interesting in itself, which means that whatever civilization made these, it's almost as if there's, you know, it sounds crazy, but a factory that's producing these and subbing out their propulsion systems for different models of crafts. I mean, it almost sounds like a car.
That's how we do it.
But it was the identical system in all crafts.
All right, now he demonstrated the amplifier to you?
Yes, that was the reason he connected up the reactor.
How was the amplifier demonstrated? In other words, what further did you see when he brought the amplifier online?
When he fired that up, he took an ordinary candle and put it probably about 6 feet in back of the emitter. And I was waiting for things to get started, but he really didn't do anything, at least that I saw, and went over and looked at the candle, and the flame was no longer flickering. It was essentially frozen the way it was.
Frozen?
Yeah. It just, the candle was there, and the flame was like a two-dimensional picture of it.
Oh, my God.
I mean, it wasn't, the flame wasn't moving, but it was still emitting light.
Which means?
Well, it could mean all kinds of things. It's just another thing that is bizarre. That you really can't, I mean, how in the world would you do that?
Now, wait a minute. Now, we know, don't we, physicists know that gravity bends and affects
light. Oh, absolutely.
Light.
I'm saying, but without using gravity, how could you do that?
You couldn't.
Yeah, exactly.
So within that field, it froze, to your eyes, it froze that image.
Right, to my eyes.
Solid.
The candle was removed, and to show me how the emitters can focus gravity, because this is very crucial to how they operate. They must be able to focus and diverge the gravitational wave.
Uh-huh.
Apparently, he set it for a tight focus and increased the power to it, and at the focal point, which was at that time, probably about 3.5 to 4 feet from the rear of the emitter,
right,
a black dot formed, a black ball. Not a black hole where it's going to suck in the desks and things there.
Yeah.
But what he was showing me was the fact that light was being bent. Now, there is nothing that we have that can do that.
That would have been at the focal point. Now, for example, with a satellite dish, a lot of people know about satellite dishes.
A parabolic dish.
And that's right. Out at a certain point, which is the focal point, on a good dish, it's about the size of a quarter or even smaller. That's what's called the focal point, where all the energy from that satellite dish is radiated right to that little tiny spot, and that's where they put the collector or the LNA or LNB to get the signal. And that's a focal point. So you're saying, just like that, at the focal point, but out in the middle of nothing, in the middle of air, there was a black dot.
Right, and that he was demonstrating the fact that the device was bending light away from the area. I mean, it was a completely black dot.
Yeah.
Later to find out, well, I don't want to jump ahead of myself, but anyway, there were a couple small demonstrations like that were extremely impressive, and you know, this is what we were supposed to be working on. And, you know, our mission was really not just to find out how it worked, but the aim of the project was to see if these systems and subsystems can be duplicated with earthly materials.
Bob, when these engines, for lack of a better word, were running, was there any audible noise? You were there in the room. I mean, was there, other than the test of putting her hand up, was there any anything that hit your sensory system that you could describe when these things were running?
On the test set up in the room, it was completely silent. I wasn't even sure if the thing was operating. However, during the test flight of the craft, with all three amplifiers operating, there was a definite hiss and corona discharge on the bottom of the craft.
A hiss?
Now, a hiss, like a high-voltage hiss. If you've ever been around you know, high-voltage power lines or high power transmitters, you must have.
Of course.
And, you have that familiar or high voltage hiss.
And you said a corona discharge.
A corona discharge, which is not a St. Elmo's fire, but a blue glow that you typically see, again, around high voltage systems, and what's happening in the air is breaking down and emitting photons, and, it glows. It's the same reason why lightning bolts are visible. It was obvious there was high voltage on the skin of the craft, and obviously it was leaking off because that sound is unmistakable. As the craft lifted off higher, and approached 20 or 30 feet, the sound disappeared, so it was obviously interacting with the ground.
Fascinating.
So just in free flight, there'd be no sound at all.
Now, do you know, you say there were three emitters on each craft. Do you know offhand how these emitters in flight were manipulated to, for example, leave the ground and then begin propulsion that would take you horizontal or vertical or wherever you wanted to go? Do you know how that energy was manipulated?
Yeah. The craft operate in two modes. It's Omicron and Delta. Omicron is using a single amplifier to move the craft, and Delta uses all three amplifiers. Whenever a craft is near another gravitational source, such as the planet Earth or whatever, it's only using one amplifier to lift itself off the ground. The amplifiers are these, like I said, or I keep using the word amplifier, the emitters are these up 4 foot long, 2 foot diameter pieces of pipe, essentially, held by a 2 or 2.5 foot 3-inch diameter flexible pipe, and these hang in the bottom of the craft. One of them points down, and it produces a gravitational wave that will lift the craft off the ground. The other two are swung almost horizontally, so in the bottom of the craft, they're really pointing out in front of it.
Gotcha.
Now, most vehicles and aircraft that we're used to either accelerate hot gas out the back or use a propeller and, throw air out the back and the craft moves forward.
Sure.
These do the exact opposite. And my best analogy for it is the old rubber sheet or the bed. If you take a bowling ball and stick it in the middle of your bed, and in front of the bowling ball, about 2 feet, take your fist and just push it deep into the bed. What happens? The bowling ball rolls forward.
Absolutely.
So this is exactly what they're doing. The craft is standing using one gravity emitter, standing on a gravitational wave, and they're using the other two essentially to make a little divot, a gravity well in front of the craft.
I understand.
And it rolls forward. It's why they look so ridiculous when they're in that low-speed mode, because it's an unstable form of flight.
Well, that was going to be my question. When they do the vertical lift, I wonder how, of course, I don't understand how that energy is distributed, but I wonder how the craft is stable as it goes vertical.
The gravitational wave is propagating from the emitter, not in a linear fashion, but it's diverging. So it's on a pedestal, almost like a pyramid.
Oh,
so the bottom is so stable.
Yeah.
In fact, as it goes higher, because the area of the base increases, it becomes more stable. It's only when it's very close to the ground that it's wobbly and kind of goofy looking
for
such an advanced machine.
No, I've got it. Look, people should understand that not just your word tonight, but thousands and thousands of people have gone to, as close as they can get to Area 51, and they have seen, there's a million eyewitnesses that have seen craft being tested over the years, So there are a lot of witnesses to what you're saying right now about how they
flew. I had, you know, if you remember at the time, I had the test flight schedule, and I brought, you know, when I started to leak some information, I brought my friends out there at night. John Lear was one of the first people out there, and, you know, we brought a big 10-inch Celestron telescope. And, you know, at that time, you could get a hell of a lot closer to Area 51 than you can now.
Yes, I know.
And, you know, we all saw what was going on.
I am curious about this. Let me ask. You obviously had been treated to plenty of security warnings, probably had to sign a bunch of crap. And so you made some kind of decision at some point to begin leaking stuff. Describe to me how you went through that metamorphosis. You know, how did you get there?
Well, I was perfectly content with the way things were going. You know, once you're on the inside, it's a different state of mind. And, you know, if you're on the outside of something, you know, hey, it's not fair, we all should have this information, so on and so forth. But, you know, you get kind of a change of attitude. Once you become privy to the information, you go, you know, those guys don't deserve to know anyway.
You know?
But that does change after a while. And the impetus really had nothing to do with me initially. Remember, they were still going through all my security, whatnot, whatever they do to...
It goes on.
Yeah, I mean, they do everything in there. They're very concerned about your mental state, because that, you know, if a person is very depressed or despondent or something like that, it's going to affect their work performance, and especially if they're trusting them with very important secrets, there's going to be a problem.
National security.
Exactly. And now, I had given a written order to have my phone monitored and myself monitored.
God, that's something to give. I mean, I know you're a pretty private person, but to give...
But I was excited to work on this. That was nothing.
More exciting than being monitored.
Oh, by far. And I was absolutely following the rules. You know, at the time I was married and I wasn't saying anything to my wife. And initially, this is where the problem began. And, you know, I mean, what do you say? You leave the house at 11 o'clock at night. Where are you going? Oh, I'm going to work.
Yeah,
really? And, you know, night after, and then you come home, you know, 6-7 hours later. Where were you? I was at work.
At work.
Yeah, and, you know, after a while, it begins to sound like you're having an affair.
Yeah, of course.
Well, that's exactly...
What happened?
That's exactly what happened. And
brother.
As time went on, my wife began to have an affair. And they knew it, and I didn't, because they monitored the phone.
This is all new stuff. I've never heard any of this.
So they had all the written transcripts of what was going on.
Oh, my God.
And they stopped calling me out to work because they had to make a decision on what to do. They were either going to just let it sit and, you know, see what happened, you know, if we broke up or, you know, that ended or whatever.
But at any rate, you were suddenly at risk.
Yeah, and, you know, at that time, they had stopped calling me out, and I kind of began to get a little concerned, and this is when I had the flight schedule and brought a few of my friends out at the time, including my wife, and, you know, showed them what I was doing at night.
Oh.
And they all saw that, and in fact, you know, we got away with it the first night, and we got a little greedy and went a couple other times. And we finally got caught. And, you know, they...
How many of you got caught in? What happened?
I think it was four of us. And we were standing there, you know, out close to Area 51 in the absolute black desert where you couldn't see your hand in front of your face.
Yeah.
Now, we had been staying there about half an hour, and... my friend Gene and I were sitting there joking about, well, maybe we should just take the base by force and, you know, just saying ridiculous things like that.
Yeah.
Now, little did we know that the security guys had snuck up on us and they were no more than 6 feet from our noses.
Listening to you say things like,
hey, right, and they had no idea what was going on. So we're sitting there talking and out of nowhere, a sniper... not a sniper scope, a night vision scope, falls on the ground. We see this little green light fall down and roll. And it came out of nowhere. You know, we had no idea. Anyway, the guy had dropped it.
Yeah.
So, you know, they walked forward and, you know, made everyone go back up to the road. They call in the sheriff. And
would these have been the Wackenhut security people?
As far as I know. I had taken off into the desert because we had all assumed if I was caught, there was a problem.
Well, that's a good assumption.
Because you know, these guys could have just wandered out there and been looking what's going on. But if they saw somebody from the inside there. So I took, I'm not even going to say that. I took off into the desert. And
they had
counted how many people were there.
Toward or away from the area?
Away from the area.
Away from the area.
You know, out into the desert. And
they saw
there were three or four people there. And then when we got back up to the road and the sheriff came out from there, I think his name was La Moreau, who's still around there, and that's when I reemerged, and he said, wait, we've got a discrepancy. There's an extra person here. Well, what's his name? And he took my license, read it into the base, and, you know, he said, okay, well, everybody can go. And the following day, I was called for a debriefing down at Indian Springs Air Force Base, which I had never been to before.
They didn't, that's very interesting. They didn't throw you in jail.
They didn't do anything.
You know, they spend the night in jail, a lot of them.
Now, the second they heard my name, the second that he read the license, they said, let everybody go. And it was the following day when I got called in, and Dennis, who was the security supervisor at the time, drove to my house, and we went down there in my car, and that's when it really hit the fan. And, you know, kind of to make a long story short, they were pissed, to say the least, and...
Well, don't make it too short. This is pretty interesting stuff. I'd actually... like to get some details of that. You called it a debriefing. Probably it was more like a let's see how scared we can get this guy.
Well, that's exactly
what
it was.
All right, then hold on to that thought, and we'll be right back. There is indeed, just over the mountain from me, a place called Indian Springs, and there is an Air Force base there, and that's where they called you, Bob?
Right.
Summoned you, said you, would you get one of the calls? You know, it's now noon, you will be, you'll be up here at some certain time, or what?
This was a little different. This Dennis called me, who was my security supervisor at the time, called me personally, and came to my house, which was
you know,
very unusual.
Oh.
And then we both drove down in the same car to Indian Springs, which is an auxiliary Air Force base in this little town, which is, you know, the base is essentially shut down, but I guess some of it, you know, remains operational. In any case, that's where they took me.
Uh-huh. And?
And that's when they started the debriefing. The first thing they brought up was, of course, the, you know, tremendous breach in security, and... They wanted to know everybody that I had told anything to, why I went ahead and did it. And, you know, I was pretty straightforward with them, but they tried to be as intimidating as possible. And
were you threatened outright?
Oh, very much so. Yeah, and so was my wife's life. So I became very concerned about that.
Do you actually care to tell us what they said to you? I mean, did they say... You know, you'll end up a lump in the desert like so many others, or, you know...
there was a lot of fear present at the time, and I don't remember verbatim, you know, what tagline they used, but it did get my attention.
Yeah.
And this is when they brought up the transcripts of my wife's affair on the phone.
Oh, that they told you?
Yeah, so I found out from them.
At that moment.
Yeah, at that moment.
Wonderful.
This was something they had to slap in my face.
Gee whiz, I wonder why they picked that moment to tell you.
Well, who knows. But anyway, that's how the separation between us really came about. It was because of that, because of, you know, bringing my friends out there to see what was going on, and, you know, That's really what set everything in motion.
All right. A lot of stories have flown around about what happened, Bob, after that. For example, you know, we have the mutual friend of John Lear,
mm-hmm.
who now, by the way, doesn't talk about any of this anymore, doesn't want any publicity. You can't blame him. He's lost some jobs. He's back working. He's doing fine, and he just doesn't want to talk about this anymore, and I don't blame him. Do you?
No. John's, I think John's rave now is about the dump up there at Yucca Mountain,
yeah.
about the nuke waste dump. And,
yeah, sure.
You know, it's the one thing I agree with and John Lear is, you know, I know everyone in Las Vegas doesn't want it there, but if you're going to put it anywhere in the country, why not put it where you've already exploded 100 atomic bombs? It's already a wasteland, you know, at that part of the test site, so...
Well, you're
anyway.
Right. That's a big controversy. Anyway, listen, there was a big controversy about something called Element 115, which was said to be some kind of fuel, an element we don't have now on Earth, that was the fuel or the what? What can you do?
Well, I guess you could call it a fuel. It's what made the reactor operate. And it's a super heavy element, something that we've theorized can exist. You know, if people think back about, you know, high school or college chemistry, you recall that as the elements get heavier, you know, once you pass uranium, they decay. And some decay very fast. As,
yes.
as the elements get very heavy, their half-lives become extremely short, sometimes microseconds, so they're just around, they exist just for a blink of an eye. Well, it's been theorized and has been some time ago that there are islands of stability somewhere higher up in the periodic chart. There are places where groups of elements would again become stable, and this occurs, what theoretically was to occur in the 114-115 area. And again,
an island of stability.
Right, where these elements are relatively stable.
Uh-huh.
And again, there is supposed to be another island of stability somewhere up in the 200s. But these are unattainable things, and no one says that nature has ever produced them, except
at
maybe
at the moment. But you know, when you talked about element 115 years ago, so many years ago, since then, interestingly, we progressed to the impossible. In other words, since you actually talked about it, they've been discovering elements moving up, right on up the chart.
Oh, they're getting close.
Yeah, they're getting very close.
They're getting close, and the half-lives are getting longer.
Yeah, I know. People back then hoo-hawed at this, but now they're not hoo-hawing so hard anymore because we're getting pretty close.
Right, and I'm sure eventually they'll synthesize it somehow. They use a... Instead of bombarding it with neutrons now, they use this new fusion technique where they fuse the nuclei of two other elements together, which is kind of an odd way to do it. But it's got, I think the Lab for Heavy Ion Research in Darmstadt, Germany, has pioneered most of the new heavy elements. And, you know, mark my words, they're going to be the guys that synthesize 115.
Huh. Bob, there was talk that you spirited some element 115 out of S4. Is that true?
Where'd you hear that, Art?
Oh, I got friends too, you know. Do you want to comment on that?
No, I don't want to comment about that. But it's, you know, that would be a good sledgehammer.
All right. Well, we'll leave that one alone, I guess. Do you think that since the time that and you know what we didn't cover, we missed it. You described the one craft, but at one point while you were there, you saw a total of what? What did you say? Nine craft. And
if I recall, that was the day. Barry and I were working in the lab, and Dennis came in and he said, come on out, there's a test flight. So there was a flight scheduled, and they were allowing me to see it. And we went from the lab out into the first hangar, which was the only one I ever saw open. And as I went out there, the craft was already outside the hangar, and sitting on the ground. I don't know if they rolled it out, it flew out, or whatever.
Right.
But as I was walking through the empty hangar, I looked to the right, and there are big bay doors in between the hangars, and they were all open, and I could see all the craft lined up. So they had an outright collection of these things. Anyway, the craft was outside, and there was a guy sitting near the door with what I surmised was an ordinary VHF radio, and this is something that to this day really bothers me, because it should be, if this is a gravity-propelled craft, which is bending and distorting all forms of electromagnetic radiation around it and whatnot, it should be impossible to communicate with the thing.
The radio should have been...
VHF radio.
It should have been trash, yeah.
Maybe it wasn't. Maybe it just looked that way to me, and it was something more advanced. But anyway, he was apparently in communication with somebody in the craft, so I know it wasn't being flown remotely. And anyway, that was the first time I got to see, and the only time, all the crafts inside the hangar.
Did you ever get to see the inside of any of the craft?
Yeah, just the one. The one I coined the term the sport model, because it, in comparison to the other crafts, it was really sleek and thin and looked like a sporty version.
Can you describe the inside? I mean, did it seem as though it was designed for, say, a human or something close to a human?
Well, it's hard to say. It was designed for something small, because certainly a 5.5 or 6 foot person is hunched over in all but the very center of the craft. It's an uncomfortable setup. It's extremely barren. There are three seats in there.
Three.
Yeah. And there is, it's all one color. There are no aesthetics anywhere. And as far as the placement of everything, there are no sharp corners anywhere. Imagine taking a seat. The amplifiers looked like tables or boxes, just to give you a simple figure idea. But it was as if the inside of the craft was all molded with these parts out
molded.
Of wax.
Molded. In other words, in aircraft, we have rivets, we have various
forms. Right. Everything flowed together as if it was made out of wax and heated and then cooled. So there were no sharp corners. Everything just kind of blended together like the entire thing was injection molded. There was no visible seam or right angle anywhere. And everything was just a dull, pewter's a little dark, but a dull aluminum color. So just being in the place, it looked very unearthly, if I could use that term.
You can, sure.
It was very unusual, because in any place you've ever been and anything you've ever looked at, there are varying colors, shapes, and sharp corners. And everything was rounded,
gotcha.
And everything was monochromatic. It was just one color.
What about apparent controls for control of the craft?
There were none.
There were none?
There were none.
That's really interesting.
There are no buttons, lights, or navigator position, or anything of that sort of the two places I was allowed to look at in the craft. Now, obviously, whoever piloted the craft was on the central level. The level immediately below it, there's a small access hatch with a collapsible honeycomb access way. And I stuck the upper part of my body in there kind of upside down. I was told to do that so I can see the placement of the gravity emitters and how they're hung and how they move.
Oh, yes.
And so that was the bottom level. Underneath that was just the skin of the craft. Now, above that, I was not allowed to venture. There was a small area above it, and on this particular craft, the hump on the top, or the dome on the saucer, whatever you want to call it,
right.
It's not round. It's kind of flat on the top. There were these black portals. I believe there were four, if I remember correctly. And there weren't windows. They were, from what I surmise, is they were some sort of planar sensor, so the craft could get its orientation in space or wherever it was, where it could, you know, these would detect positions of stars or something like that, so it can get a fix on its orientation and, you know, where it is, where it's going, and that sort of thing. Now, that's my guess.
So,
I have no idea.
But you surmise that there probably was an area of some control that you didn't get to see.
Well, either that, or there is a different type of control.
Yeah,
you know, that has no obvious, you know, buttons or knobs or anything.
Well, I know now, even in our fighter jets, they're beginning to get to the point where they put on helmets and they can actually think commands. I mean, we're doing that here on Earth.
Yeah, it's not out of the realm of possibility that the craft would operate that way. How we interfaced to it, I would love to know. Because if, in fact, it did work that way, using an alien creature's mind, who in the world came up with the interface? And what would you have to go by? So there's so much information I would have loved to have known to complete the picture for me.
But you would surmise from what you did see that these craft were probably made for creatures that would be, on average, much smaller than humans.
They would have to be. They would have to be almost close to half our size to comfortably fit in there.
Huh. Now, you never, ever saw any alien beings.
No.
Were there, between you and your buddy or anybody else that you ever talked to up at S4, were there any discussions of beings? I mean, it would be, how would there not be discussion of
about who piloted the craft, and they called them the kids. That was the term they coined.
The kids.
The kids. And that's probably because of their size or who knows what. But that's it.
That's pretty interesting, though. They called them the kids.
Everything looked like it was a set up for a child. So maybe that's where it came from.
Bob, but how far since you have left, which is a lot of years now, do you think, for example, when you were there, how much progress had actually been made in either duplicating or beginning to get a handle on how these generators operated and the beginnings of duplication or trying to duplicate what they were doing?
Well, I don't think they got very far. You know, I use this analogy probably the last time I was on your show. And, you know, if you took an ordinary modern-day motorcycle and just transported it back in time to the 1800s, to the wagon train days, and just left it out front, and the morning everybody woke up and discovered it there with the keys in it. Now they can poke around and prod with it and play with it, you know, and eventually they're going to figure out how to start it just out of sheer luck. And it's going to start and it's going to run and they'll be proficient at driving it as long as they keep playing with it. And when it runs out of gas.
After crashing quite a few times.
Well, yeah, but they'll pick it up and they're pretty tough and, you know, go on. And when it runs out of gas, it'll never work again. It'll sit there.
Yeah.
And however, when it comes to duplicating it, if they wanted to make one, they couldn't even make the plastic fender on the thing because that material is just amazing to them. Right? I mean, you know,
that's a
polypropylene or something like that. They just look at it and go, wow, it's solid, but it bends and it melts. And, you know, they couldn't even make a fender or a turn signal on a thing.
Much less the engine or the...
Oh, forget about the working part. But this is exactly where we're at. We got a really cool toy, and we've played around with it enough to where we know how it works, and we can make it move around. But when the fuel runs out or something else happens to the craft, that's it.
Then you've just got an inert piece of stuff that you never figured out.
Right. I don't think they're ever going to duplicate, in our lifetimes anyway, what's there. You know, they may use it and may get some other information off of it. Now, again, I'm going on thoughts that are 12 years old, so they could have made some tremendous strides since I was gone, and I was certainly not privy to all the information, but that's the impression that I was left with.
All right, hold on. All right, once again, here's Bob Lazar. Bob, an obvious question, and one coming from Madison, Wisconsin, on my computer is, were there any signs on any of the craft of obvious damage?
Not on the craft that I worked on at all. And, you know, everybody's wanted to know, well, how did we get them?
Sure.
And, you know, that's information I wasn't privy to. I would love to know, too, was this, you know, you hear so many stories in UFO lore about an alleged exchange of technology. You know, did this actually occur? And I've heard people say, well, you know, we know there are crash retrievals. We have inside information. And you can't tell me that somebody came from 30 light years in 9 different advanced craft and they all crashed. It just, it's not possible. So, you know, I could certainly see the Roswell crash occurring, but I just don't believe that flying saucers come here from a tremendous difference and they just miscalculate the weather conditions and they wind up crashing all over the place.
Yeah,
it doesn't make any sense.
I hear you. What about, did you ever learn anything of the material that the craft were made of? In other words, could you take a blowtorch and cut? Could you damage, dent, or otherwise bend, spindle, or mutilate the material the craft was made of at all?
I don't know. Again, that was compartmentalized. That's the metallurgy guys that got to play with that. The only contact I ever had was going in the craft, and then the first day walking by it, I stuck my hand out and slid it along the craft, and you know, it just felt cold, so I assume it's metal. But it certainly could have been an advanced ceramic or some other unknown material. But
it kind of felt like metal, though.
Yeah, it was. Metal has that, you know, cold feeling to it. The surface didn't feel exceptionally smooth. It was aluminum is the only thing that comes to mind, just, you know, unfinished aluminum. But I doubt it was actually that. But
do you think was there any sense of weight? In other words, did you ever have an opportunity to see anybody attempting to lift or move any of these craft, getting an idea of the kind of weight they were trying to move?
No, I didn't. The only thing that caught my eye in relation to weight was above the craft in the hangar. There was one of those suspension cranes with a hook on it, and it was rated at 10 tons because they had that in big bold lettering on the side. So that makes me think, well, if they in fact use that to move the craft, it weighs less than 10 tons.
Huh.
That's about as far as I can go on that. But I've heard people make comments that, you know, actually they only weigh a few pounds, but I don't think that could possibly be true. Number one is, you know, at different times moving into the craft, you're sitting on the extreme edge of it, and it would certainly teeter. Plus the amount of equipment they had moved into the craft, lights and whatnot, for investigation of it, it makes me think it's something of some, you know, pretty sizable weight. It's not, you know, it's certainly not a flyweight piece of material.
Bob, you know, a lot of the interesting news stories I get about world affairs and maybe wars between India and Pakistan, all the rest of it, they come from the United Kingdom, which I think is embarrassing. It annoys me that I've got to get to news I can't get here from the UK. Your movie is going to be made in the United Kingdom. Are you going to have any input at all during the production of this movie? Are they going to fly you over?
I don't know. I imagine they would. I imagine I would be put in a position as technical consultant at the very least, you know, if they want it to progress in an accurate, truthful fashion. And I believe that Bruce did go over that already. So, you know, I'll at least be in that sort of position.
Bob, you have a list of names, which you've revealed tonight, of the other people that were there. You're speaking right now, I'm certain, to many of those names, and they're listening to you right now. What would you say to them at this point? I mean, you're out in the public, and your story has been hanging out there now for a lot of years, and now it's going to be even more public with a movie. What do you say to the other people that were up there, given a chance, which you have right now, to say something to them?
Well, you know, that's changed over the years. About the only thing I would like to say to him is contact me in some way.
You would think maybe by now some of them would have gone through a thought process that would bring them to the point where they'd be ready to be in contact with you and maybe others.
Yeah, and there's obviously a reason they haven't. because it's been 12 years. And
yeah, there is, and they haven't, and you're still alive. You wonder about that?
Not really, because the way things progressed, it would have been really detrimental to the program and to them if all of a sudden I disappeared. And probably the only reason for that was that John Lear's suggestion and insistence to go into George Knapp at the time.
Yes, and George Knapp is a Las Vegas...
he's an investigative journalist.
Investigative journalist, that's right, a big-time one here in Las Vegas. He's done a number of UFO specials over the years, and you went to John, and John said, go public, go to George Knapp.
Well, at the time, I think there was a few days there where I hid at John's house.
I remember that.
Tensions got pretty high, so I just looked for a place I could stay other than my house because I had no idea what was going on. And the decision was made to go do that, and in fact, George broke in, more or less. It was at the top of the 5 o'clock news in Las Vegas, and I went on in silhouette and said what was going on. And, certainly if anything would have happened to me from that point on, it would have cast everything in stone and said, hey, you know, this guy said so-and-so, and, you know, it looks like it was true. If he was just a nutcase, what would you bother killing him for?
Well, they didn't erase you, but they kind of erased... part of your employment histories and as much information as they could about your history with them, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, Bob Exler was one of the guys that did the research, and I think he was a NASA systems specialist, and now, I don't know about now, but then, you know, was pretty heavy into UFO investigation, and he had some contacts down at the IRS, so I let him have all the information. My W-2 form from there, you know, with Naval Intelligence and Social Security number, and, you know, he went after everything. And from the IRS, he got notified that information regarding my Social Security number is classified, that the numbers, the employer designation numbers on my W-2 form, were for, I forgot what bizarre government agency, but they were valid. And, he did bring up a lot of good information, and it ran into a lot of block walls that were completely inaccessible.
Even your history at Los Alamos was somewhat erased, although I'm remembering that you came away, or somebody came away with your name on an employment list or a phone list from Los Alamos.
Yeah, that was the only thing that they couldn't have deleted, was the old printed phone list. And, you know, that's one of the things. On top of that, what proved to be a big plus, too, is remember, again, the jet car article. And in the front page of that newspaper, in the first few paragraphs, now this is a small town, Los Alamos, everybody knows everybody's business, they say, Bob Lazar, a physicist working at the Los Alamos Maison Physics Facility. This is the Los Alamos newspaper. So, you know, you can't go back in time and get rid of that paper. So I had that. I had my name in the internal lab phone book directory. So, you know, they were stuck with that before. They had denied it for years. He never lived here. He never worked here. You know, it's just a big lie. And
yeah, they did reach back and erase as much as they were able. They just didn't get it all.
Yeah, George Knapp is the only guy at the time that I, not that I trusted, but also had, you know, the ability to do this. And I flew with him back to Los Alamos and went back to where I worked and to the people I worked with and, you know, the areas I got him into in the lab. And, you know, he did a lot of footwork.
Look, I've had a lot of dealings with George over the years, and I've come to trust him. He's a
very trustworthy guy.
He certainly is. All right, very quickly, just a couple questions. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Bob Lazar. Anything real quick?
Is that me?
That's you.
Oh, okay. I was wondering, hi, Mr. Lazar. Do you feel that we had any technology or do have technology to go to the moon? I don't feel that we did.
Well, you mean you think we never really went to the moon? Is that what you're saying?
Oh, yes.
You know, a lot of people have been saying this to me just in the past couple weeks. There's a good friend of mine, John Ferrat, who's kind of a big wig in Hollywood, and, you know, he absolutely, and this is a real knowledgeable guy, and apparently there was some show on Fox where they aired all the old Apollo films and analyzed them. And I never saw this, but it seems to have convinced him that we never went to the moon. And I don't know. I've spoken to Edgar Mitchell, who was the sixth man on the moon, and it sure seems like he went there. I don't know. I really don't know.
You know, Mitchell made an interesting comment to me. I've done many interviews with Ed, and one question that seemed to really stump him was, Ed, do you remember what was it like walking around on the moon? And he said, you know, it's really strange. I just don't remember that many details of the whole thing. He said, I obviously remember it, but there are some details that strangely are missing, and he did make that comment.
It's possible to have faked the whole thing, but
who knows?
We know that the shuttle goes up there because you can look up in the sky and see it go by.
You certainly can.
So why is it that much more difficult to go to the moon? It's not that far away.
Uh-huh. First time caller line, you're on the air with Bob Lazar. Hello.
Hello, how are you doing?
Okay, sir, where are you?
North Hollywood, California.
Okay.
Yes. Hi, Bob.
Hi there.
Still driving the Corvette?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's all right. Anyway, are you familiar with the Lockheed facility in Burbank?
The Skunk Works?
No, not Skunk Works. Talk about on the premises of the airport where the Janet flights took off.
In Burbank?
Yeah, Burbank, California.
No.
You worked in the 80s. What time did you work at Groom Lake facility?
What time? The time is varied.
No, I mean the year.
That was in 88, 89.
Okay, so, I'll give you a name. There's a guy who worked out, I don't know if he worked in your division, but the last name of Hayes. Do you know him?
Alright, well, let's hold it there. Do you want to disclose whether the name Hayes is on your list?
There is a name Hayes on the list.
Oh, there is a name Hayes on the list, really?
Yeah, there is. Now, I don't know if there's a billion Hayes in the world, but...
There's a Hayes on that.
There's a Hayes on the list.
Really? Okay. Okay.
I mean, there's also a Jones, too.
Yeah, I know, but what if still...
but there is a Hayes.
What are the odds?
Right.
Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Bob Lazar. Hello.
Yes, sir.
Where are you, please?
Here in Perump, Nevada.
Perump. Oh, and listening to?
K&I.
K-N-Y-E.
Yes, sir.
95.1 in Perump, Nevada. Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Mr. Lazar, I'm a big fan of yours.
And
I was wondering how you feel about how the government's disavowed knowledge of you and disrespected your work and everything.
Well, I'm, needless to say, not too thrilled about it. There isn't much I can do, but, there will never be a common ground between us. As far as I'm concerned, all ties are broken and all promises are broken, too. And, you know, that's one of the reasons I'm on the air. You want to treat me like that? Well, guess what?
Here's what you get.
Yeah.
If you, if they came back to you and they said, you know, with all the water that's gone onto the bridge, Bob, we've made a lot of progress. We'd like to take you up there and show you how much we've done, how far we've come. Impossible as this is, if they came to you with that and said, however, there are going to be a million conditions and more security checks and blah, blah, blah. Would you be able to turn that down? Would you tell them to go fly a kite?
I would certainly love to do that, but in view of what's gone on, I can't possibly trust them. You know, it's a completely remote, isolated area, and once you're there, they could really do anything. It's to say, hey, you're not going home.
And you wouldn't go home. You'd just be not even a lump in the desert, but far below it.
Who knows? I mean, maybe that's all fantasy, but, I cannot trust them. And I would absolutely love to get back into the technology. I mean, it was the greatest scientific experience I've ever had, you know, working with it, and I'd love to see what else they've done and, you know, love to lend a hand and become part of the project again, but I can't.
I'd say the chances of them coming to you like that
are zero.
Yeah, absolute zero anyway. Just interesting question. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Bob Lazar. Hello.
Bob?
Yeah.
You fascinate me by saying what part of the universe this thing came from. Where did it come from, did you say? How can you say that with definiteness, with being definite, assuredness in your voice? And was your job to reproduce this fuel and this fuel called 115? And how far did they ever fly this thing, or did they tell you?
All right. Well, first of all, the assuredness in his voice came from the fact that they told him that's where it came from. Correct, Bob?
Right. I did not determine this myself. And again, this is just in a written satellite briefing of the project. So whether or not that's true or not, you know, I cannot stand up to that fact. But it is possible, because the other things that I read in the briefings that I did get hands-on experience with are accurate and true. So I don't have any reason to disbelieve it, but because I don't know it for a fact, it just kind of sits in that special place in my mind where it possibly might not be true. But again, you know, why throw a lie in there if we're trying to get all this work done and find out what the basis is of this thing? The origin of it may have something to do with the operation of it, so I don't think they would have taken the opportunity to lie about it there. So
now,
I kind of believe that was true.
Now, knowing what you know about the drive systems, you said, you referred, I think, earlier to some of the Belgian sightings. When you consider all the UFO sightings, and I'm sure you've seen a million pictures and moving video now of UFOs and all the rest of it, you think the Belgian sightings were perhaps accurate with what you know about the drive systems. Have you seen any other film or stills of UFOs that look like the real McCoy to you?
Absolutely, because once I started looking into it, now I don't research this stuff anymore, and I get a lot of people asking me UFO questions, and actually, believe it or not, it doesn't interest me. I liked being involved in the project, but I don't, you know, look into UFO stories or research this stuff. But when I did, when I said the craft operate in two modes, the Omicron and Delta configuration, when it's transitioning from Omicron to Delta, the way the craft flies through in space is belly first, not flying horizontal like you see in a science fiction movie. And as the craft leaves the ground in Omicron mode, they perform a roll maneuver where the craft raises, and you know, eventually you see it at a 45 degree angle, and then it becomes straight up and down 180 degrees.
Right.
The amplifiers come up to power, they focus on a point, and the craft flies belly first at the target. And you see a lot of UFO photographs here and there with crafts ascending in the sky at a 45 degree angle but flying up, or sitting at odd angles in the sky. And at least from what I can guess from the photographs, if they in fact are genuine, it looks like the craft are transitioning from one mode to another.
And so you've seen quite a few of those.
I've probably seen three or four of those.
Three or four?
Yeah.
So the majority of UFO photos are by you pretty much dismissed, but every now and then one hits you and you say, hey, look at that.
Yeah, if it has something that clicks somewhere, but you know, these days, you just take a picture into Adobe Photoshop and, you know, you can make anything.
I do know. Bob, I can't thank you enough for coming on tonight. With regard to your movie, Blue Book Film, hey, do you have any idea what the title might be?
No idea. The only thing they talked about are the people that might play me. Is it James Spader, Kevin Spacey, or Mark Wahlberg? So that's about all I know at the time.
Brother, good luck with the movie, and thank you so much for laying so much new detail on us tonight.
No problem, Art, and I'd just like to say hi to my buddies Debbie and Nancy out in Chicago and the incredible Duger.
Good night, Bob.
Good night, Art.